This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
It's Thursday, May 2nd, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. In February, Kristi Noem, governor of North Dakota, was the favorite in betting markets to be Donald Trump's running mate. Then Tim Scott gained momentum in the predicted betting markets. His shares started trading in the mid to high 20s in March, and Noem was down to the teens. They were actually tied on April 9th, 21 cents for a dollar. In other words, if you invested 21 cents in the Noem or Scott stock and it hit, you'd have a dollar at the end. And if you invested $2,100, you'd have $10,000. Only stuff happens. And in this case, it happened to Kristi Noem's dog. Yes, as we all learned about a week ago, when her book leaked, Kristi Noem shot her dog. And since then, crickets. Well, sorry, let me complete the sentence. And since then, Cricket's death has halved Kristi Noem's value as a stock pick. She was trading at 5 cents today, losing 75% of her value. And what was her value? She was pretty. She was MAGA. No, I'm not saying she was pretty MAGA. She was very, very MAGA. But also she was pretty. And she still hasn't lost that. Not that Donald Trump would base a pick on such considerations. But she is now seen as sunk. And by the way, if you were wondering if her stock did worse than Donald Trump's, you know, Donald Trump's media has had a little bit of a rebound. Was trading almost at 70, hit lows of 22. Now it's almost up to 50. But let's not get into that. Let's get into the fact. And I learned this. I thought about this. And I learned this even more than my suspicions would have indicated. Turns out that Americans really hate when people shoot their puppies. Now, I had some suspicions that Americans wouldn't like this, that it would be underwater in terms of the approve-disapprove. And I based those suspicions when I started telling my wife, Michelle, hey, Michelle, did you hear that Kristi Noem took her puppy and shot it? And no, I can't hear that. I can't hear anything about anyone doing such a horrible thing to a dog. And listen, the Peachfish Productions director of special projects, she was a potential no mega supporter. Listener, she was not. But it's not just my keen intuition telling me that shooting the dog is what hurt her chances. Here is the AP's coverage of that.
Politicians and dog experts are criticizing South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem after she wrote about killing a puppy in her new book.
Yes, experts. I know I've made the case before, but this Noem dog shooting episode, RIP Crickets, has underlined just how crazy our reliance of experts is. Perhaps there have been other cases in recent history that have been as silly, useless, superfluous a reliance on experts. I've been clipping some columns. Here is a New York Times story about RFK Jr. But according to the independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr., it is President Biden who poses the greater threat to American democracy, a view that Mr. Kennedy shares with Mr. Trump himself, and that democracy experts called absurd and, quote, preposterous. See, I was all on board with RFK's highly credible assertion. But then you call on the democracy experts and you don't name them, but you give them a word in a quote. And now you change my mind. Then there was one use of experts or their close cousin analysts about the failed referendum in Ireland. Sometimes the experts, they hide there as just an analyst, but you know, it's their expertise we're calling upon them for. Here is the lead of that article. Voters in Ireland rejected two proposed changes to the country's constitution that would have removed language about women's duties being in the home and broadened the definition of family beyond marriage, dealing a blow to the government that analysts said suggested the weakness of the campaign to pass the proposals. Yes! Yes, I think after some analysis, that is a valid conclusion. That the two referenda, which failed spectacularly, one where the no votes were 68%, the other, which was close to 80%, it might in fact hint that there was a weak campaign for the yes votes, in that they all stayed home, and in also the fact that the underlying ideas of the proposal were actually should be kind of popular in Ireland. So yeah, the experts convinced me on that one. And here's my favorite use of experts. This was an older story about the prosecutor Fannie Willis, whose side trial over the hiring of her boyfriend might well have derailed the Georgia Trump prosecution. New York Times reports, quote, legal experts have pointed out that Ms. Willis could have avoided this particular controversy had she not had a romantic relationship with someone who worked for her. Yes, that is true. I co-sign. And if any of those legal experts or the democracy experts or the Irish disaster of a referendum experts, if they also train puppies, it might be a good move for a news organization to lock them up, hire that guy or gal, have them at the ready so we can definitively say the experts have spoken. And I will tell you this, longtime observers trained in the field of stupid suggestions say that is a good example of one. On the show today, the Arizona Senate votes to embrace post-1864 abortion rules. But first, Charles Kupchan, who's a senior fellow and director of European Studies at the Council of Foreign Relations and a Georgetown professor and worked for the Obama administration and authored U.S. policy about Ukraine for many, many years, has joined us before to talk about Ukraine and will join us again. The Ukraine government is due to get $61 billion for arms. Will it matter? Will it make a difference? Charles Kupchan answers up next.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Congress has approved and Joseph Robinette Biden has signed a $61 billion aid package for Ukraine. This is desperately needed military aid, but how much of an effect will it have on Ukraine's attempt to defend itself or gain back some of the territory, the 18% of its territory from before the war that it lost? And then there are bigger questions of how to end this and what the upcoming stakes will be for U.S. affairs. Joining us once again is Charles Kupchan, professor of international affairs at Georgetown, a veteran national security official, worked for the Obama administration. Roy, is happy to have you back on The Gist, Professor Kupchan.
Good to be with you, Mike.
I know you know all about this, but let's just talk military first. How much of an effect will it have on this, specifically the U.S.'s billions of dollars on Ukraine's military prospects?
If the question is, will this make a difference in terms of Ukraine's ability to defend itself, the answer is a resounding yes. The Ukrainians are on their heels right now. We're hearing that for every 10 shells that the Russians launch, the Ukrainians can launch one. Their cities are being pounded from the air. Their infrastructure is being degraded. And a lot of this is a function of the fact that really since last fall, the U.S. has not been providing assistance. And the Ukrainians have been running out of artillery shells, of air defense, of armor. So the material is just beginning to arrive. I'm guessing that some of it was sitting on pallets, ready to go, but a lot of it is in the pipeline. And the question is, how much territory can Russia gain now before that hardware arrives in Ukraine? And I'm guessing the answer is some, but not a lot. Mm-hmm. And once that comes in, I think we're looking at a much better situation on the battlefield for Ukraine and a clear ability of Ukraine to do a better job of holding the line. You also mentioned, Mike, what about taking back more territory? There, I would be cautious. I think the Ukrainians gave it their best shot in the summer and fall of 2023. It didn't go very well. They ran into a buzzsaw of mile after mile after mile of Russian defenses, minefields, trenches, tank traps, more minefields. So I'm not expecting to see a lot of territory change hands in 2024.
Do the Ukrainians know that?
I think everybody knows it, but nobody's saying it. Mm-hmm. And that's because there is almost a taboo about speaking frankly toward the reality that Ukraine is not likely to restore territorial integrity on the battlefield. You still hear a lot of talk about Ukrainian victory, that once the U.S. is supporting the country again, when more aid is flowing from Europe, Ukraine will win. And I think that I understand where that's coming from, right? This is kind of let's rally the forces, let's keep up the fight. But I also worry about the lack of a more realistic, sober conversation when it comes to maintaining the support of our publics.
Yes.
Because our publics are watching this story and they want to say, well, what's the theory of the case here?
Right. Where's our publics going? Are the United States, Ukraine's, Germany's, Poland's.
Everybody.
Yes. All the states.
Everybody. And we've already seen over the last 6 months just how fickle our own politics can be. Mm-hmm. And so I think at some point we need to have a more realistic public conversation about where this war is going, about the fact that the Ukrainians may not win. And if that's the case, what's plan B? How are we going to end the war? And how are we going to ensure that the 81% of Ukraine that is still under Kyiv's control turns into a success story?
Right. Well, if winning is defined as the reestablishment of early 2022 borders, very unlikely, especially Crimea. If winning is defined as Russia going away, the territory controlled by Ukraine and sometimes tenuously controlled by them right now being maintained by Ukraine, and Russia either abiding by treaties or just being dissuaded and rebuffed from attacking again, then I think we could maybe talk about winning.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. But the definition of winning that you and I would identify is not politically acceptable among polite company. You know, you talk about that version of an end game, you get hit with a torrent of criticism. You're selling out, right? You're a Putin apologist. I'm not a Putin apologist. I'm a realist. And I think that if Ukraine ends up more or less where it is now, and we're able to give it the ability to defend itself for the long haul, to rebuild its economy, to have it functioning as a prosperous democratic state anchored in the West, that's a defeat for Putin. That's what he didn't want. We defer to a later day the big question of what happens to those parts of Ukraine still controlled by Russia. I don't think the Ukrainians are going to get it back on the battlefield, as I said. It's not inconceivable to me that they may get it back one day at the negotiating table after Putin is dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if listeners to this are saying, well, then the $61 billion, which was part of a larger aid package and obsessed Washington and cost me as a taxpayer money, if people who very much wanted that aid package to go through, if that is not going to help Ukraine win, what is the point of it? And I think the logical answer is it very well might keep them from losing. But what you're pointing to is the don't lose message is a much harder message to rally behind and to endorse publicly than the let's win this thing message.
Yeah, and that's why I think ultimately our elected officials need to have more honest conversations with the people that elect them. Because there still is this kind of gap between what we say we're doing in Ukraine and the realities on the ground. And I think that's one of the reasons that you saw American support for continued aid to Ukraine lag, because people were saying, well, we gave them all this stuff. They made a run at it. They didn't take back eastern Ukraine and they didn't take back Crimea. So what's going on here? And I think that a redefinition of victory, a redefinition of success is the way to go here. And I do think that had the United States not approved this package, a collapse of Ukraine was not out of the question. It's completely conceivable that Russia would have been able to break through Ukrainian defenses, take Odessa, take Kharkiv, maybe make another run at toppling the government in Kyiv. I think with this aid package, those kinds of outcomes are quite remote.
Yes, and I am only going by public accounts. Maybe you have more insider knowledge, but you do say that we need to have a more honest discussion about what the real stakes are and the goals are. From what I understand, from having read, Mike Johnson was moved by what I think of as an honest discussion. He was briefed. He was, you know, was privy to briefings that I think only the president, maybe one or two other members of the government would have. And it was put to him, not that this money will help Ukraine win the war, but do you want the destruction of Ukraine or the demise of Ukraine as a democratic state on your conscience? And I think that's fair. And he answered, from what I understand, I don't want that to be attributed to me or my legacy.
I think that's right. And I think one of the reasons that we ultimately got this package is that a reasonable number of Republicans were looking at this and saying, we could, by the election in November, be responsible for Ukraine's collapse, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're withholding the funding. The Russians are advancing. We don't want to own this. And so, you did have a large number of Republicans vote against it because that's what they're hearing from their constituents when they go home on the weekend. But I do think that the Republicans were in some ways scared about owning the loss of Ukraine to Russia.
Yeah. Do you think if this amount of aid were given earlier in the conflict, it might have had an effect on where the literal battle lines are drawn now? In other words, you talked about mining and trenches and entrenchment. You know, if Ukraine had the ability to be more aggressive a year ago, might the map look significantly different today?
Not a whole lot different. You know, there are those who say, well, if we had moved more quickly, if we had given them F-16s earlier or given them tanks earlier, then they could have liberated the rest of the country. I don't think there's any silver bullet here in terms of a weapon system.
Golden HIMARS?
No, it's just you know, the Ukrainians are doing an unbelievable job of holding the line against a country that is much, much bigger, right? Three times the population or more, a much bigger military industrial base. Even though we've thrown the book at them in terms of economic sanctions, their economy is growing. We have not been able to strangle them economically. So it really is a David and Goliath kind of story. And the Ukrainians are doing an amazing job of defending themselves. But I don't really see a scenario in which they develop the military capability to defeat Russia. And they are facing numerical constraints when it comes to warm bodies. Zelensky just signed into law a new conscription, lowered the age of conscription. But because of demographics in Ukraine, that, you know, you just can't suddenly bring another million soldiers to the front. So I think what we've seen since the end of the Ukrainian offensive are losses in the north that would probably not have happened had the aid continued to flow. But we're talking about, you know, a town here, a town there, few miles here, a few miles there. We're not talking about a radically different battlefield outcome than had the United States been providing a steady flow of military aid.
Right. So imagine if Bakhmut hadn't fallen. All right. I can imagine it. It wouldn't make, you're saying, and I think I agree, it wouldn't make that gigantic of a difference.
No. I mean, I think what you can argue is that there'd be a lot less dead Ukrainians, that a lot of the missiles and drones that and glide bombs that are coming in and now hitting Ukrainian cities, they would be picked off. Because the Ukrainians, using the Patriot, using Stingers, using other kinds of air defense systems, were doing a good job of preventing Russian air assets from getting through. That's not been the case over the last few months. It will be the case once American assistance gets there.
So that's mostly a function of the armaments they have at their disposal, not at, as I've been reading about, new Russian tactics of flooding the zone with drones and missiles that the Ukrainians are defenseless against, even if they did have Patriots.
It's some of both, but it's primarily a lack of the necessary assets on the Ukrainian side. I mean, the Russians are bringing into the field, you know, glide bombs, hypersonic missiles. They attempt to flood the zone by sending in waves of drones that might overwhelm Ukrainian defenses. But it's mainly the absence of the necessary hardware on the Ukrainian side that has let so many attacks hit their targets.
So if and when a negotiation were to take place, what do you think gets either side to the negotiating table so that they, A, understand, okay, this is pretty much the situation? I mean, if either side thinks that there is a reasonable chance of a giant success, I don't see them giving up. So how do you get the people who could negotiate to realize this? And then once you do, does the negotiation just solve itself, or there are a lot of other complications and levers to be considered?
Well, I think one of the big questions that lurks behind your question, Mike, is What does Putin want? What are Putin's war aims? And I don't think we know. I think he would like to subjugate Ukraine. He would like to turn Ukraine into some kind of fractured, failed state, which then somehow finds itself back in a Russian sphere of influence. I think he's living in la-la land, in the sense that he has alienated just about every single Ukrainian that's alive. You know, you may find a few Ukrainians in the East who are pro-Russian, who are happy that the Russians are there.
Right. But this is the idea that, as he often says, there's no such thing as a Ukraine nation or nationalism in Ukraine. If there wasn't, and you could rebut that, he created it. Maybe if there was no idea of a nation before the invasion, there is now. Thank you, Vladimir Putin.
Exactly. You know, I mean, some historian is gonna write a book in the not too distant future called "Who Lost Ukraine," and it's gonna be a short book because you just put Putin on page one and you're done, because he really has turned Ukraine into a country of 40 plus million seething people who want nothing to do with Russia until the end of time. So I think the idea that somehow he's going to conquer the country and pull it back into the mothership is fanciful. And then the question is, okay, what's the consolation prize? We don't know. You know, I think that at some point, if Putin realizes he's not going to make much more progress, if we get a stalemate, if the front line just doesn't move anymore, he may come to the conclusion that it's time to call it quits, to say that those parts of Ukraine under my control now belong to Russia. I have defended ethnic Russians. I have defended Russian speakers. End of story. We're not there now. I don't think we're going to get there this year because Putin's probably waiting to see who wins the U.S. election, assuming he'll get a better deal out of Trump than he would out of Biden, if in fact Trump were to win. And then the question is, what about the Ukrainians? And, you know, Zelensky right now is not in a position in which he could move toward a ceasefire and some kind of negotiation. He doesn't have enough public support to do that. So at this point, I think we're simply looking at a continuation of the fighting, what we call a new frozen conflict, in which the line doesn't move that much, but the fighting kind of dies down. And then at some point, I'm guessing after the U.S. election, we may see a window open for negotiations.
In the beginning of the war, we saw all these images and there was so much evidence of Ukrainian bravery and success, but also Russian incompetence and the failures of Russia. And it was shocking how the Grand Russian Army, especially the infantry and their armored divisions, were underperforming. And my question is, were those examples perhaps exaggerated in our minds or in the reporting? Or was it the case that there were pretty shocking failures, but Russia addressed them?
I mean, I think there were shocking failures. I also think that the Russian political and military elites underestimated the resolve of the Ukrainians to fight back. They thought they were going to roll into Kyiv in a number of weeks and it would be over. And that's not what happened. The Ukrainians innovated. They took advantage of the fact that they were on the defense. They exacted huge costs on Russian columns that were advancing along open roads. I think that the Russians have done a reasonably good job of learning from some of their mistakes. But let's be honest here. You know, the Russian military has taken grievous losses. This is not a top flight military that is about to pull itself together and move again on Kyiv. So that it's for that reason that I think we're probably looking at a military stalemate and a new frozen conflict. Neither side is likely to generate the combat capability to win. And so I think we'll see that stalemate emerge over the course of this year. And then maybe next year, we'll see whether some kind of diplomacy emerges.
Charles Kupchan is a professor of international affairs at Georgetown, senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations, Obama administration, national security official. We check in with him. And it's been too long. I've ignored Ukraine for too long. So I want to thank you for helping orient us and the listeners. Thanks so much, Professor Kupchan.
Good to be back with you, Mike.
And now the spiel. The Arizona Senate yesterday narrowly passed a bill updating the state's abortion law from the pre-Civil War statute that was on the books. In April, the state Supreme Court upheld an 1864 law. It was a 4-2 decision with Justices Lopez, King, Bean, and Clinton Bolick supporting the reinstitution of the 1864 law. Yesterday, on the floor of the Arizona State Senate, Senator Shauna Bolick, wife of Clint Bolick, stood to speak and began telling a story, which turned out to actually be three stories of three different pregnancies. Her first story was of an unnamed woman whose pregnancy had complications. This woman was surprised to find herself pregnant, and she was incapacitated by the experience.
She was both elated and nervous. Morning sickness became a real issue. She learned of her pregnancy around week 3. Everything made her nauseous. How was she supposed to drive to work and carry on? She ended up carrying plastic garbage bags in her car in the event she felt the urge to vomit. She even had trouble keeping down basic saltine crackers as she sipped water and flavored electrolytes. She scheduled an appointment to see her OB as soon as she could.
The anecdote went on for quite a while. Bolick was reading from a script. She didn't have much intonation. She didn't make much eye contact. She plowed ahead, determined. One of her fellow Republicans, who had already recorded his vote for keeping the 1864 law, objected.
Make your point of order.
Yeah, I'm just asking if she would stick to the repeal of the bill. She's kind of going off in a number of areas, but I would ask that she stick to what's on the board.
Okay. The request, Senator Bolick, is that you make your comments germane to the bill.
At her first appointment, this young woman was given the option at a future appointment of having a transvaginal ultrasound. The doctor told this woman it was likely.
Senator Bolick's concession to the objection was that barely discernible pause, if that was even a concession at all. So Bolick went on with her story, and it ended sadly. The woman in the story had complications. The doctor said she needed a DNC. What's a DNC, she asked. It's like an abortion, she was told, but she didn't want an abortion. She didn't believe in abortion, but she needed one. Her baby wasn't going to survive, and they wanted to make sure that the woman did. Senator Bolick transitioned to the next story. It was of a woman, yet again, with complications from a pregnancy.
For the next few months, this couple spent time preparing for their baby together. Having hyperemesis during her entire pregnancy, she prepared the baby's nursery. A few months before her due date, she attended childbirthing classes, and they highly encouraged writing up a birth plan.
This drew a second point of order, again from Republican Senator Jake Hoffman.
This bill is specifically to repeal the abortion ban.
Senator Bolick.
Abortions, Mr. President.
Senator Bolick, can you please explain how your comments are germane to the bill?
I will continue. The doctor also offered to write a prescription for an anti-nausea medication since the C-band nausea relief wristbands were not working. At the
Senator
same
Bolick,
appointment...
Senator Bolick, please, I need you to explain why your comments are germane to the bill.
The comments are germane because not every pregnancy is the same.
Okay. Proceed.
Senator Bolick did proceed, telling the story, this one of a switch in hospitals, a complicated delivery, but of a healthy baby. Soon, as Senator Bolick continued, citizens in the gallery began yelling. They were quieted. Her colleagues seemed exasperated, but she continued. And she told the story of a third pregnancy, which, true to her word, wasn't the same as the first or the second. Now, at this point, you should know, as Bollock's Republican colleagues knew, as the observers in the gallery knew, as presumably her husband, who approved the legislation, knew, because Bollock has gone public with her stance, that Shauna Bollock is a no vote on having the 1864 law stand. She was speaking in favor of a different law, which would allow abortion up to 15 weeks. She was to be one of two Republican senators to vote with all the Democrats, thus turning a 16-14 Republican advantage in the Senate to a 14-16 defeat of the Republican Party line on this bill. Bollock did this at great personal risk. She was assailed by abortion opponents. She was criticized by the peers in her own party. But as she explained, not every pregnancy is the same. And she feared a total ban would have consequences on women. Maybe women like her, because, and you may have suspected this, because that's how sometimes these things go, she was the woman in all three stories of pregnancies. She said that a 15-week ban is a reasonable ban, and a total ban, meaning the 1864 law, went way too far. Women would surely be denied medical intervention in their pregnancies. The 1864 ban, the total ban, that would wind up hurting women and hurting babies, in her telling. In making the case, she engaged in a sort of dialogue with her own husband. And I quote from the ruling, we must consider the legislature's construction provision in SB, that Senate Bill 1164, when discerning the act's meaning because it is part of the bill the legislature approved. Quoting Bollock, concurring, quote, if the legislature agrees on findings, purposes, and definition, it becomes our duty to ascertain statutory meaning through those prisms. The co-author of that bill, SB 1164, was Shauna Bollock. Shauna Bollock is not an abortion rights advocate. She's not anti-Trump. She's not a never-Trump Republican. She's, I don't think, a moderate Republican. Her son is, and I think actually it's her stepson. I think this was Clint Bollock's son from a previous marriage. Excuse me if I got that wrong. I tried very hard to figure it out. But Clint Bollock's second son is the godson of Clarence Thomas. The judge, Judge Bollock, describes Clarence Thomas as a mentor. And you should know Shauna Bollock sponsored a bill that would allow the Arizona legislature to revoke the certification of a presidential election. And she supported a resolution urging Congress to throw out the results of Arizona's presidential election and award the state's electoral college votes to Donald Trump. In her speech about the 1864 ban, she said that Margaret Sanger, founder of Planned Parenthood, should be removed from the Arizona Women's Hall of Fame. She referenced the, quote, preborn. I have, you probably have too, heard many, many stories, moving stories offered by female legislators who talk honestly about their own experiences with pregnancy. It's usually moving. It's almost never actually moving to anti-abortion voters. Yesterday, Shauna Bollock shared a similar story, but it was interesting in how it failed to hit all the beats of the usual pro-choice narrative and offered some other details, like there was the medical technician wearing a burqa, which robbed the patient, who was Bollock, of eye contact or connection.
Since this medical professional didn't speak English, it made even harder to be in the same room together while her abdomen was being poked and prodded. Tears ran down his mother's face. This young mom had so many questions and no answers.
So this was a different kind of testimony off the usual progressive script. It included a tactical element we must acknowledge. Bollock knows a 15-week ban is much better politics than a total ban. But the vote, the story, her defiance in telling the story, standing up to her critics, bucking her party, it showed something. Shauna Bollock is not pro-life, but she's also not an automaton. She's not a party hack. She's not someone without principles. Her principles aren't exactly mine, but she impressively stuck to them, and to great effect. The Senate passed the bill, as had the Arizona House a few weeks earlier, thanks to three Republican defections there. There is a gap in the implementation of the laws. It is seen or thought that for a few months this summer, the 1864 total ban will be in effect unless the Secretary of State or the Attorney General move through the courts to block it. But today, Governor Katie Hobbs of Arizona signed the bill. In November, the voters will get to vote on a referendum allowing abortion, not for 15 weeks, but up to 24 weeks. Senator Shauna Bollock says the 24-week ban goes too far. Her Republican colleague, Jake Hoffman, who you heard offering those points of order, says, quote, "We are getting rolled again by two Republicans to repeal one of the best, strongest pro-life measures in the country." And that's it for today's show. Corey Warra produces The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is in charge of special projects for Peachfish Productions. Was never going to support Gnome. Just an exaggeration for comedic effect. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umperu, Jeeperu, Dooperu. And thanks for listening.